Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. There are many ways in which Canadians express their national identity. Through song, poetry, tattoos, pride over historic and international achievements, the celebration of multiculturalism, the singing of the anthem, voting in an election, and so many other expressions, large and small, help us define who we are and who we think we are as Canadians. Sport has always played a central role in this search for identity. From cheering for Team Canada at the Olympics to fanatically following your local sports team, sport has always been a way to unite Canadians. But sport has also played a role in helping to express the Canadian experience, especially when that Canadian experience is one that embraces Canada's rugged, hostile, and beautiful environment. In the 1920s and onwards, the famous painting Cabal, known as the Group of Seven, created an international sensation by painting Canada's landscapes, presenting to the world what has been considered Canada's first true school of art. At the same time that these great painters were presenting their material to a world fascinated by Canada's landscapes, Stanley Thompson was doing the same thing with golf courses. Thompson embraced the Canadian terrain and built golf courses into it that celebrated the unique and rugged nature of the Canadian landscape, bringing the player into nature. In many ways, Thompson too was an artist who was also, like the Group of Seven, celebrating the Canadian experience through expressions of nature. This is Season 8, Episode 5, Stanley Thompson and Golf in Canada. Now, to get to the heart of this matter, we have brought back one of our guests from Season 7. Jordan Goldstein has a PhD in sports history and 7-plus years teaching sports philosophy, sociology, and history. He published his first book, entitled Canada's Holy Grail, in 2021, a book that investigates the political motivations of Lord Stanley in donating the Stanley Cup and as an act of Canadian nation building. Now, Jordan recently quit academia to build a coaching and consulting business, FIA Academy, and to work on curriculum development at Synthesis School. My first question to Jordan was, what are the origins of the game of golf?
It's difficult for us to nail down when the sports we have a good understanding of when they started really started. Like here in Canada, for example, you still have debates raging on like when the very first hockey game was played. Even though if you want to kind of go by the letter of the record, it's March 1875 at McGill University with James mm-hmm. Creighton and his friends who wrote down the very first rules. But then you've got, oh, but we used to play it this way in Halifax or in Kingston. We've done this. So everyone's kind of got their like, well, we did it here first, right? Even the game of baseball is similar, even though we've got the records of, you know, Alexander Cartwright writing down the rules of baseball in 1845 for his Knickerbocker baseball club in New York City. You know, there's records from the 1830s from Beachville in Zora, Ontario, of rules that were similar to that, right? And so are those, is that the very first baseball game? Golf is even more vague than any of those, because it's a game that has evolved over centuries, mm-hmm. that has mixed kind of like culture and land and geography all together in one. You know, there's a parable that we can even think about. It's like the game of golf is kind of like a walk for a Scottish shepherd out on the turf that's up by the coast. If you can imagine walking around maybe with like a companion dog, just out on an afternoon with your walking stick. And as you're walking, you notice that there are kind of like some rocks on the ground that are a little bit roundish. And so you start knocking them. You start knocking these kind of these rocks around. And then all of a sudden, one of them pops into like a little bit of a divot or a little bit of a hole that's just naturally met out. And then the shepherd thinks, hey, you know, this is actually kind of fun, right? And you can even imagine the upside down of a shepherd's crook, right? Knocking around some of this stuff. And then over time, he comes back, right? And he starts to notice, well, these balls roll a little bit better, and these divots and these holes tend to allow me to aim. And actually, now that I've walked this a few times, this kind of looks like a hole, right? That I kind of know, hey, this divot down there is a good one for this kind of a size. And then over the centuries and over the time, the land starts to mix with the walking and with the gameplay. And then all of a sudden, this game of golf emerges out of almost like the mist, you know, like almost like the Scottish mist, right? In the morning, a ship that comes in just out of nowhere. So that's kind of the way I like to think about the beginnings of golf. When does golf begin to be seriously played? It's around the time that the other sports are being codified, the very beginning of modern sports. So like, for example, it's around the time of like cricket. So mm-hmm. in the 18th century, golf starts to become more formalized, but it's not yet organized. That doesn't happen until the 19th century. And in particular with some improvements and sort of the spread of the game out from its ancestral or spiritual home in St. Andrews. Mm-hmm. It starts really with the very first professional golf architect or professional golf teacher or professional golf ball maker or professional golf club maker, Alan Robertson, who was the groundskeeper at St. Andrews in the mid kind of like the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. And he was instrumental in popularizing and kind of spreading the game outwards and sort of modernizing and standardizing the game a little bit more. And then he passed on his knowledge to his protege, old Tom Morris, who is maybe like the greatest legend of the game in terms of being from St. Andrews, spreading the ideas of golf architecture from St. Andrews to the other parts of Scotland. He famously went to Prestwick when Alan Robertson was still the groundskeeper at St. Andrews. Tom Morris left and started up a club at Prestwick. Then he came back to St. Andrews and was responsible for a lot of the changes that have become sort of standard in golf in terms of like the 18-hole course structure. A lot of the modern design features in terms of like why you would design a hole in a particular way emanated from Tom Morris, old Tom Morris. He was one of the, he competed in the very first national championships in Britain, the Open Championship, the oldest championship in golf, I believe is 1860 or 1861. I forget exactly. Which a fun part about that is they actually competed for a championship belt. So, you know how like boxers and like pro wrestlers, they've got the belts. Well, the very first like golfers until they got the claret jug, I think it was 10 years later. the winners of the first British Open golf tournaments all had these amazing and fancy belts. So there's some pretty fun ones. But old Tom Morris, then his son was also like a crack player. Young Tom Morris, perhaps the greatest golfer who ever lived. Some of his records certainly are incredible in terms of how young he was, how far ahead he was of everybody else. You just outclassed them. Think of like a young Tiger Woods of the 19th century, but tragically he died young. And so we never got to see kind of like his great superstardom or his legacy. But all this is kind of happening kind of like the mid 19th century in Scotland. And that's kind of like where the golf craze emanates and starts from. And then in the mid 19th century, it begins to spread outward to England and then to the other English speaking parts of the world, the British Empire, the Dominions, Canada, eventually Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and the United States as well. So it's kind of at that moment when the Canadian golf story begins, as the game is being really refined and popularized in Scotland, and it's just starting to break out into the rest of the English-speaking world.
Is there a way, can you identify, historically speaking, when golf is accepted or becomes sort of an accepted sport in Canada itself?
It would be around that same time in the 18, okay. The beginning of the late 19th century, sort of like the latter third. We end up with the very first golf clubs. Yeah. I believe the first golf club in Canada was 1873. And I think it's either Hamilton or Montreal, but I want to say Hamilton. '73, but it's around that time it's around this time that the very first golf clubs are being established. We don't have sanctioned competition yet, but like at this point there really isn't much competition in Canadian sport anyways. The big sport in Canada is the big team sport is baseball, and the big individual sport is rowing in terms of like spectator sports, and a serious competition. There is no hockey yet. Hockey is basically just being invented by college kids. So Canadian sport in itself is in a bit of an infancy. There's horse racing, and there are the games that are organized by the garrisons, by the British troops that are sent over from Great Britain. But otherwise, there's not much else really that's happening outside of a few well-established sports, again, more like baseball, cricket, horse racing. And some winter things. Pardon me.
But it's really interesting because golf basically arrives in Canada. I mean, it's because we, of course, and we've talked about this before, you and I, but hockey is so embedded in this idea of Canadian identity, Canadian sport and identity, but golf is kind of just arriving at the same time that hockey is sort of being first played informally and first codified and stuff like that. So it's really clear that golf is arriving in Canada or being accepted in Canada at the same time that other sports are also being sort of accepted and spread. So this is a really interesting period at the end of the 19th century when sport is becoming really important to many Canadians, and many different sports are becoming very important to many different Canadians. And then then you write about this really incredible character, Stanley Thompson. So maybe you could give our listeners, who is Stanley Thompson? Where does he emerge from? What's his sort of historical significance?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one important thread that we should make when talking about like the Canadian acceptance of particular sports or sports becoming a part of Canadian culture, right? The people who are Canadian nationalists, like the Canadian nation builders, are mostly of Scottish descent, right? If you think about our prime ministers and a lot of our very first civic leaders, they all have Scottish names, right? And so the Scottish culture itself, I think, is a lot more currency in terms of its connection to Canadian culture than say like an English culture. I wouldn't consider Canada very English. Certainly like a city like Toronto at that time would have been English, but Montreal dominated by Scottish, and Montreal was the big city. So it shouldn't surprise us that the two national sports of Scotland, golf and curling, are also important sports in Canada. Curling, the very first sports club essentially that was founded in Canada was a curling club. So there's an interesting cultural link between these two Scottish national sports, curling and golf. they share a lot of characteristics with each other. And they're very much evocative of that, of a Presbyterian identity, like a Scottish religious flavor, if you will. And just to tie it all even more into an interesting knot, St. Andrews is the spiritual home of Presbyterianism in Scotland. It's like the religious ecclesiastical center of kind of like Presbyterian and religious thought. So it's a very important place, and that's where golf comes from. So golf has this very outstretched spiritual national significance to the country of Scotland. So it shouldn't surprise us at all that it would also take root in Canada. And Stanley Thompson himself is the son of Scottish nationals, like of Scottish immigrants. So he grows up in east part of Toronto, basically. Okay. He grows up in the east part of Toronto. And his brothers are known as kind of like the famous Stanley, the other famous golfing family. His dad basically got them jobs as caddies when they were young at one of the local clubs. And they all became pretty good golfers, like in terms of winning youth championships and playing in the Ontario amateurs. So they all competed. Stanley Thompson became known as the godfather of Canadian golf architecture. So the golf courses that are made in Canada, the ones that are the best, the ones that all of the Canadian architects have emulated and copied, were built by Stanley Thompson, essentially. And Stanley Thompson himself belongs to a larger international movement of golf course architects known as the Strategic School. And these Strategic School architects wanted to return to the essence of golf, and especially to the way that the courses were played, back to the time of people like old Tom Morris, for example. So in between old Tom Morris and Stanley Thompson, there was a school of golf course architecture that was very similar to the way that all the other sports were turned into like one standard arena that we play. Like the size of a hockey rink is one size, right? The size of a football field in Canada is one size, in America it's another, but it's the same, you know, if you're on one side of the border or the other. Even in baseball, where we've got the irregular outfields, we still have the diamond, right? It's 90 feet between the bases, right? So every sport has a playing field that is exactly the same. Well, golf tried to go down that road and tried to make the courses a lot more standard. So if you can imagine a golf course with perpendicular lines and isosceles triangle bunkers and like teardrop mounds. So all of these perfect geometrical shapes, but they don't really fit in the natural landscape. And these courses were also very difficult, right? If you weren't a very good player, your ball was going to be in a trap, in a hazard, in the rough. You were not going to be having a very good time playing these courses. And there was a bit of a golf boom and then a bit of a bust. So around the time when Stanley Thompson gets into golf course architecture after serving time in the Canadian forces during World War One, so this is around like the 1920s and just kind of in the few years before that, in the 1910s as well, golf course architects began to return to this idea of Tom Moore's, which was like a natural school of golf course architecture. The golf hole blends into the environment. It's almost as it just emerges, kind of like that beginning story I was talking about in Scotland, right? Well, that's how St. Andrews had evolved over time. And when Tom Morris was shifting around and creating new holes and making old holes better, he did it in a way to preserve that idea or that feel of the landscape. And one of the hallmarks of that natural school is that there's multiple ways to play the hole. There's not just like one way to play the hole. A player who hits short has a way to get there. A player who hits long has a way to get there. A player who's a bit erratic has a way to get there. And these strategic school architects, they worked for golf clubs, and golf clubs want people to come out and play, right? So they have to figure out, well, how do we get people who may not be good at the game to come out and want to enjoy the game? One of the ways is options. Make sure smaller players who aren't as good can navigate and have a good time on the course. So this idea of strategic golf is multiple routes to the hole. Okay. For those golfers out there, people who are listening, you know how we have multiple tee boxes, right? You've got the forward tee box. If you're a short hitter, you go to the forward ones. They didn't even have that until that was a strategic golf course architect innovation, which again makes good sense. If you add it onto the handicap system, now we can have good players and bad players playing against each other. And that's what the strategic golf architects wanted. They wanted people to come out to have fun. So multiple avenues to the hole. But what was truly revolutionary about these strategic golf architects was their ability to create beautiful works of art out of the landscape. And that's what they were. They were these artists who looked at a forest or a piece of land and thought, this is where a golf course could go because it looks as if it blends in with these natural features, with this contouring of the land, right? And when you're on a good golf course today, that's the kind of feeling that the architect wants to evoke. Like this hole just emerged out of the natural landscape, even though I had to terraform this hill and I had to bring in these trees and I had to put, you know, and everything here is essentially created, but it's created in a way that makes it look as if it's natural and that it blends in. So Stanley Thompson was the first person to bring this idea to the Canadian landscape when he started designing what would become the most famous Canadian golf courses ever created when he started out his firm in the 1920s.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And you write about how he develops his own kind of unique school. You call it the heroic school. So maybe you could give our listeners a bit more detail as to why makes this a unique school?
Yeah, my thesis is that the heroic school is actually a Canadian national adaptation onto the strategic school. So if the strategic school gives us multiple options to the hole. St. Andrews is sort of like the textbook example of this. But imagine you're at the tee, right? And there's an option for you off the tee to hit straight. There's a place where you can go wide to the right. And there's a place that you can go wide to the left. And each of those positions gives you a different way to get in to the green in two shots, right? Mm-hmm. So there's multiple ways to get there. The penal school is like, there's only one way. And if you don't mm-hmm. go that one way, you're not going to get there. The strategic school is kind of like, well, there's the heroic school is kind of like a blending of the strategic and the penal. It's okay. Like, there are a couple ways for you to get there. One way is really risky, right? Think about having to, I don't know, clear like 215 yards to get over a water hazard just for your drive. So you have to drive the ball minimum 215 yards, right? Mm-hmm. Or there's a landing spot that you can go around, but it's going to require you now to take an extra shot to get to the hole. So you do have an option, but there's a safe play and there's a risk. And the what the golf architect does in the heroic school is they trick you and they tempt you into making they tempt you, take the tricky play, try to make that carry, try to hit it to that one side of that bunker, right? If you're on a par three, Stanley Thompson was the master of par threes for exactly this, and his par threes are world famous because he tricks you and he tempts you. He does something with your eye that makes you think, well, I can do this. But then all of a sudden, when your ball's in flight and it doesn't work out for you, you think, oh, shoot, he tricked me. I actually couldn't do it. So the heroic school uses nature to evoke a challenge, right? Mm. It says, if you think you can do this, here's your option. If not, take a safe play. And why I argue that's a Canadian adaptation is because at this time that Stanley Thompson is creating these golf courses, Canada is still trying to figure out its national essence. And I know that you wanted to eventually talk about the Group of Seven, and my paper's on the Group of Seven. I find it striking that in 1924, Stanley Thompson is at the base of Jasper Mountain in Alberta, building out the world's very first mountain golf course, right? Which become Jasper Jasper Golf Club, which is one of the most world famous courses. So here he is doing something no other golf architect has ever done, building a golf course in a mountain, on a mountain, which is, he's also built some golf courses in north, in kind of like Muskoka area. So very rocky terrain, not a place like the traditional Scottish coast where golf comes from. So golf architects at this time are building in locations and locales that are not traditionally hospitable to building a golf course, because you need a particular type of soil and you need a particular type of agronomy to essentially pull this off. So he's out there trying to figure out, well, how do I bring this strategic school to this Canadian mountain range? Lauren Harris and J.E.H. McDonald, two of the founding members of the Group of Seven, the very first Canadian national school of art, they're at the summit. They're on top of Jasper Mountain in the summer of 1924, painting the mountain peaks on Jasper. So we've got Stanley Thompson kind of at the base of the mountain, and we got Lauren Harris and J.E.H. McDonald kind of like in the middle and at the top of the mountain. And they're both Canadian artists, and they're both working on these, like, what will become masterpieces and expressions of Canadian nationalism in different ways. But what is it that binds them? It's this tackling of the harsh nature of the Canadian environment. Like, that's the story of Canada, right? It's like, it's a harsh, it's an unforgiving terrain. The settlers who came and colonized the country had to do so with bravery, courage, help, obviously from the Indigenous who lived here, but grit and guts and resiliency and determination. So when I was talking about the Scottish character of Canadian national identity, think about the Highlanders, right? The people who endure like those really tough weather conditions, and they do it with like that stoic attitude, stiff upper lip, that like all this stuff is very, very much rooted in this experience that comes from a harsh and unforgiving terrain and having to live there. This is why kind of like a Scottish national character and a Canadian national character go pretty well together. And so that's the heroic adaptation. It's like, well, we're out in nature. Nature challenges us. There's a drama of nature. There's a beauty. There's a danger element of nature. And we contend with all of that in our understanding of what it is and what it means to be Canadian. And we know that through our experience of living on the land and surviving on it. I mean, that's what that's the whole lore of the Indigenous. It's like the of the land, survive of the land. When the French and British settlers came, they were in awe of the physical strength and bravado and stoicism of the Indigenous tribes, because they survived in these incredibly harsh conditions and were just physically strong and big. So that idea of tackling nature is in the Canadian experience, and it's in our Canadian national identity. And so when you're thinking about a heroic type of a golf course where it's like, take on this challenge, and it's the challenge of nature, well, to me, that's exactly what a Canadian national expression is. It's a nature challenges us. Nature evokes us to bring our best to the challenge. And through that, and through us conquering that challenge, we become one, or we become more bonded to the land. And then that becomes an expression of our community and of our culture. And there's not much to bind the Indigenous, the French, the British, and then all the people who've immigrated and who have been born in this land today, right? Especially with the fractious nature of our national identity from its beginning. But that's the one thing everybody who lives here shares. But it is that experience of enduring the environment that, yeah, I think that's my thesis on why Thompson is he is the creator of it. There's a little bit of a technical distinction. There's a very famous American golf course architect, Robert Trent Jones. And he did an incredible amount of courses, and he and Stanley Thompson were actually in business together. But Trent Jones learned under Stanley Thompson, and then he took what he learned and then he transported it down into the United States. So they call him the father of heroic golf, but he learned it from Stanley Thompson. So Stanley Thompson is the real father of heroic golf, which then allows me to make this Canadian nationalist spin on.
Like you say, he's the father of this school. How, just like in numbers, do you know how many courses and through what time period Thompson is creating, building courses and designing them?
Basically from The earliest, I believe, design came actually before he was sent off to World War One, although it's not like fulfilled. But most of his work was done in the 20s and the 30s, although he was designing courses in the 40s and up into his death in the 50s. He's credited with somewhere around 150 designs in Canada alone. In Canada alone.
And he did. Did he design international courses outside of Canada at all?
He did, not too many. As I mentioned, he was a master at the time of building golf courses in many different terrains. So one of the hallmarks of the strategic course architects was that they were particularly good in one type of a terrain. So again, like the Scottish coast is a perfect place for golf because it gives us this like soft turfy grass, right? Like think about the grass needed on like a putting green or on a fairway, like very fine, very spongy. It's very difficult to recreate those types of conditions in other places naturally. So this is also like a very technological phenomenon. So golf course architects, they're like artists, they're part artists, they're part scientists, right? And they're part like sportsmen. So they're these very interesting figures, and especially this strategic school, they're the ones who they view themselves first as artists, which is why I like to make the connection between them and the Group of Seven, is because they view themselves as artists who shape the land to create something of beauty. And what they create is a sporting field. It's a place where we get to play sport on. Like a golf course is it's probably the only piece of art in the world where you actually get to go and have a competition on it. Right. You'll have known this, David, as playing golf. When you go to some golf holes and some courses and you just look at the tee box and you think, this is spectacular. I could just walk through here and be very happy because this is such a beautifully manicured and well thought out design that it just, when I'm here, I just feel like I'm surrounded by natural beauty. And that's one of the things that these strategic golf course architects wanted. They wanted natural, they wanted this natural features and this beauty of the course, right? The strategy, the playability, they called it skill democracy. That was one part, but the other two tenets of design philosophy was natural features. The course has to look like the environment that it's in, and it has to be beautiful. It has to evoke this sense of majesty, of drama. And so when you're thinking about like Stanley Thompson building a course in Jasper, and this was, and he followed this up with his design at Banff a few years later, the way that Stanley Thompson does this as an artist is one of the ways we can understand it is through his bunkering. So if some people have played those courses or will note it, the bunkers on each of the holes are designed specifically to mimic the shapes of the mountain peaks that you can see on each one of the holes. So Stanley Thompson is reflecting, right, the mountains in the hazards that then he's challenging the player to take on or to walk away from. So every little element of these courses, right, is being essentially influenced and inspired by the land on which it sits upon, right? And that creates a very special relationship, as you were saying, between the player and the course. And I don't believe any other sport allows that type of relationship, which I think gives a special place for these golf course architects as unique in the world of sports for what they're able to create, right? There are golfers have a bucket list of courses they want to get to in their life, right? They want to go for historic reasons. They want to go for scenic reasons, right? But they also go because of the challenge. Like, I want to try this course because it's got this hole with this feature in this place and these amount of people have played it and there have been these tournaments, right? And all of that goes into it. So these golf courses become real testaments of our history, real testaments to our history. And, It's a totally another interesting part of Stanley Thompson's connection to Canadian nationalism and identity is a lot of his designs were built inside of Canada's national parks. Oh. So Jasper, Banff, Cape Breton, but also Green Gables and PEI. So his designs are actually tied into the national park system, and the national park system again has this ability to create a national identity through the land or through our connection and experience, during our connection and our experience with the land. The landscape is art. I talk a little bit about the connection as well between the Parks Department and the promotion of the land as, in essence, Canadiana, and then how these golf courses were folded into like tourist experiences and were promoted as part and parcel of that, of that, of that connection as well. So Stanley Thompson's connection to the nationalism of this country runs quite deep, actually. His position as essentially sculpting out places in our national park system for Canadians to go and essentially experience a part of Canadiana.
Was Stanley Thompson recognized internationally, or was this like after his death that people started to really see it?
No, he was known as one of the greats. He was known as one of the titans of strategic golf course architecture. There's kind of like a godfather of that school. His name is Dr. Alistair McKenzie. He was Scottish, and he's the one who kind of brought these, him and along with a couple of other Scottish guys, Donald Ross. For golfers out there, you might know the name Pinehurst. Donald Ross is the architect of Pinehurst down in 1903 in North Carolina. That's a penal school design, but it's one of the ones that kind of lasted. Another old penal school, just because I know you're a golfer, David, is Oakmont. So Stanley Thompson was known. Dr. Alistair McKenzie came to survey Jasper a few years after it was built, and his notes were essentially like, this is one of the finest golf courses in the world, essentially. It was like, for him, it was like Jasper, St. Andrews, and it hadn't been built at that time, but in the 30s, it would then have been Augusta. Like, these were like the big ones. The other one he was talking about was like Cypress Point or Pebble Beach or the National Golf Links of America. Like, these like historic, legendary courses, and the ones that were known at that time in the 20s to have been like the best. Stanley Thompson's work was often seen on par. And he was known as just this master. You asked me if he had built courses in other locations. He built in Brazil. He built in the Caribbean, because he was the only person who was willing to take on the challenge of building in these exotic locales and locations where it would be difficult to recreate the ideal agricultural conditions to have a nice golf course, you know? And so Stanley Thompson was known for his ability to bring in the right types of grasses, to talk about the right types of sand, to build the right types of greens and fair and the right types of irrigation systems. And he was just an absolute master of putting not only the artistic vision to life, but then the scientific and agricultural knowledge to put it all together.
That's fascinating. Maybe for our listeners, because we're wrapping up now, but maybe for our listeners, could you give us, like, I don't know, in your personal opinion, a couple of what you think are the best Stanley Thompson courses or Stanley Thompson inspired courses that maybe some of our avid golf listeners might recognize?
Yeah, well, most of the best courses in Canada, I mean, pretty much all the courses in Canada, I would suggest are Stanley Thompson inspired courses. In a sense, as I mentioned, he had his hand in over 100 designs in Canada. And so if you're learning golf architecture in Canada, you come into contact with Thompson. Most well-known ones I've already mentioned: Banff, Jasper, Cape Breton Highlands, Royal St. George's, where they just held the Canadian Open at Royal St. George's here in Toronto. I don't live in Toronto, but it's close to me. It's close enough. At where you're playing in Vancouver, Capilano. Most of his work is centered kind of in Ontario. I played in a Stanley Thompson tournament in 2019 at Dundas Valley, which was lovely. There's a lot out there. What's nice about some of the Stanley Thompson courses are there are some that are publicly available that you can play. I know one in Ontario that's a public course is Kawartha, which is up in Peterborough. And it's ranked one of the top public courses in Canada. Cape Breton Highlands always ranks very highly, used to rank very highly. It's still a great course, a little bit more accessible. So a lot of the top quality courses in Canada, you could say, are just touched by Stanley Thompson. And even the ones that aren't directly related to that tree, they're kind of designing courses in that fashion where it's like we use nature to evoke drama and beauty. And then we challenge the player with something on that course that that is a natural feature or something that's related to that landscape.
So it really isn't an understatement to say that Stanley Thompson is one of, if not the most significant golf course architect in Canadian golf history.
He's the golf course. He is the Canadian, he's the godfather of Canadian golf course architect. It's him. He's the one. Everybody kind of comes after him. But in terms of Canada, yeah, it's he's the one who put Canadian golf courses on the map, and he's the one that all the Canadian golf course architects essentially live in the shadow of. And most of them, he might not be their favorite golf architect, but if you had to ask them who's the biggest in Canada, like they're all answering Stanley Thompson. He is inducted into a lot of the Canadian Hall of Fame, Sports Hall of Fames, for very good reason, you know, because he does have that outsized influence on the game, right? And in particular on its spread and on this unique relationship between the landscape and the game in Canada. I don't think it's a stretch to say he's the one that created that Canadian link in the strategic school that took that connection to nature to even more of an extreme extent, because that's our Canadian expression. That's our Canadian national identity.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Boris. That's at DocBorys. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Patreon. And you can find us on all podcast listening devices. And please do not hesitate to write and leave a comment. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.